Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 25 of the Theatrical Mustang Podcast. I'm your host, Katie Woodzik. This episode is with poet Susan Rich, and it was fascinating for me because I've known Susan since I've worked at Hedgebrook, so for about 3 years, and I didn't realize what a world traveler she was, that she had been in the Peace Corps, that she was a Fulbright scholar. She's just traveled all over the world, and it made me appreciate her poetry in a new way. And so I think you're really going to enjoy this interview with Susan. This episode is sponsored by KLMXYZ Creative Communications. You can visit them at klmxyz.com. You should use them for all your graphic design and marketing needs. I highly recommend them. I also want to let you know that participation registration is now open for the second annual Queer Pride Parade on Whidbey Island. I'll have the information in the episode description, and that's free of charge. So if you want to march in the parade, that's going to be happening August 2nd. They want you to do so, and you're going to have so much fun. I rode in the parade last year, and it was a beautiful rainbow of people on Whidbey Island, and you're not going to want to miss it. So, without further ado, please enjoy episode 25 with Susan Rich. So I'm sitting here with Susan Rich in her gorgeous writing studio in West Seattle. Welcome to the podcast, Susan.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So tell me about this space. How long has it been here? How did it come about?
So the space has been here, I think we're getting close to 7 years, a magical number. And it, as you can tell, is a former garage. In fact, you can still sort of see where the door's slats are.
Sure. Yeah.
And I left that there because I didn't want to get too fancy, to take myself too seriously. I wanted to remember from the cement edges, I'm working in a garage, and this is a working place. It's not just a pretty room. And it came about because my friend Kelly Russell Agadon had decided she was going to get a writing studio, and she had a whole big plan to dig outside her house and go to, I think it was Lowe's, and get a shed. And I got kind of envious, and I was very honest about my envy, and I said, that just sounds so great. I want one of those too. And we have writing dates every month, so she was here for a writing date, and she looked around, and she said, you don't need a shed. You have a garage. So I couldn't really disagree with her. At that point, it was filled with boxes of stuff, everything from my, like, junior high school yearbook to pots and pans and just everything that when I had moved from Boston over a decade earlier was here. It had never cleaned up. So it was a work in progress, and I think it took me maybe about a year to get it together. I had a former student come over, and we spent an entire day throwing things out. And I would say, Robert, look at this. And he'd say, yeah, very nice, Susan. And then we would keep going.
Very nice, but you don't need that.
Right. I mean, he was very helpful. Anyway, as you can see, there are two wonderful windows. One window looks out on the garden. The other window looks out on flowers from the next door neighbors. And so, essentially, although it was a very messy garage, it had a great spirit to it. And maybe spirit's not the word I want to use, but the feel for it was immediately apparent that this was a great spot. So a little bit of paint, a floor, and some insulation, less than $5,000, quite a bit less, and I had a new space.
What has the importance been for you to have that this separate space for creativity that's separate, that's not just a desk in your house, that's, you know, a space you have to exit, go down the stairs, like physically separate yourself from your living space?
It's magical, absolutely magical. I never had a treehouse when I was a child, but I always wanted one. And this, I think, is my adult treehouse. And it's a designated space. No papers that I need to grade come in here, no bills, only creative work. And so it's really separated from the rest of the house. I have to get out and walk there and take things with me. And I can remember the first poem I wrote in here, and I thought, I have to become a better writer if I'm going to give myself this space.
Wow.
And at least for that one poem, I really felt it. I really felt like I had created this space, which was saying, you have to take yourself seriously. No matter all, you know, I had had a couple of books published. I had had other things happen. But this seemed wildly significant to designate a special space just to my creative work.
How long have you been writing poetry?
Since the third grade. There was a long period when I stopped in between, but my third grade English teacher, Mrs. Schiavo, made us do poetry, and I didn't think it was a cool thing like all of my students, and we had to memorize some, and something kind of stuck. So I started, I guess, when I was in eighth grade, that kind of time when you're 13 years old and there's all this angst and you're not sure what to do and there's hormones moving around. And that was when I started writing, and I had, again, another wonderful English teacher, Mr. Katz, and he brought my poem to the principal. I got called to the principal's office, which, you know, was not something that seemed like a good idea. And the principal and my teacher asked if they could use it as the basis of our eighth grade graduation.
Wow. Do you remember the poem or what it was about?
Yeah, I don't think I can. I don't think you want
you
me to quote
it.
But it was a poem entirely of questions, and two of the questions were, "Who am I? What do I want out of life?" And then it just went.
Was there sort of an inner bell then for yourself, like creatively, where you're like, "Oh, was it that outside recognition that sort of said, this is something I can sink my teeth into. This is something I want to have a long relationship with."
You know, it was a surreal experience even then. And I didn't have any confidence when I was younger. So I knew I loved poetry. I read Audrey Rich and Denise Levertov and Elizabeth Bishop fairly early on. But I also knew that I wasn't as good as those women. And so it was a relationship that I had, but that early recognition didn't feel like it got followed up particularly. When I was in college, I had teachers who really told me, do something else, kind of unsolicited male poet advice that I really should maybe take up children's books, which I think would be a great thing, but they weren't saying that as a great thing. So it really wasn't until I finished Peace Corps, I would say, when I realized I had lived 2 years in the Republic of Niger in West Africa, that I had all of this stuff kind of bubbling up in me, and I decided that although I didn't think I would ever publish, I would write for myself, and I would do this thing that I loved because I had gone to graduate school and gotten a job in a different field, and so this would just be my thing on the side.
So can we dig into that trajectory a little bit more? So you went undergraduate, was it, what did you study? Was it English or was it composition?
Undergraduate was actually University of Massachusetts, and I was an English major who had a focus in poetry, so I was able to do that. But it was teachers that were teaching in the MFA program there, and so for the most part, they had no interest.
Interesting. It was just something they had, you know, an obligation that was with their teaching.
The only teacher I had then who sort of changed my life was Madeline de Vries. And Madeline de Vries was only in Massachusetts for a year or two. She was a former nun who became a poet, who grew up in Oregon. And so she was willing to work with me. I had this idea of a, you know, undergraduate thesis, but I needed an advisor. So once every week or every 2 weeks, I would go to her office absolutely terrified. And she would take out her red pen and she would mark up my poem and tell me to go write it again.
Wow.
And even though I was scared to death of her, she treated me with a great deal of respect because we were both studying poetry together. So although, you know, I think she had some real questions about my ability, she was willing to spend that hour with me. It turns out she lived in Seattle when I got here, and she remembered me. She came to every one of my readings, and she's now, I think, 94, living in Oregon, but I got to know her as an adult.
That's powerful. All it takes is one bad teacher or one good teacher, right?
Yeah.
It's the power that they hold for encouraging or discouraging creativity. And so after college, did you go right to graduate school, or were there, was there some time in between?
So I dropped out of college. Oh. That was a 2-year hiatus where I was trying to be a novelist. I was living in Scotland, waitressing and bartending to make a living, if that's what it's called, so I could work illegally and have fun. And then I came back to get my undergraduate degree and worked in a bookstore, managed a tiny little bookstore in Amherst, Massachusetts, which was fun. It sounds fun now because it has such a romantic notion, right. But you may well know that when you finish college, you don't really know what you want to do.
Absolutely.
Creative writing degree, hello, what will I do with that? So I went into Peace Corps.
And did you, when you applied for it, is there any say over where you go or what you want to be doing?
A little bit. Since I had an English degree, that meant that I would teach English. I asked for Nepal because that had the sense of being the most beautiful and wonderful place to be a Peace Corps volunteer, you know, word on the street. But I didn't get to go to Nepal. I went to West Africa where there was a great need for Peace Corps volunteers. And I was going to say wonderful, but it was more complicated than wonderful. It was a very layered experience, and I'm very, very glad I did it. There is nothing else in my life that changed me, I think, as much as those 2 years.
I mean, what were the highlights, or what really stuck out specifically about your time there?
It sounds funny, but the thing that came to mind right away is it taught me humility. It taught me what it's like to live in a culture where, you know, my white skin meant that I stuck out. It didn't have the local language. And so I struggled, and I was all by myself. So it's all of that stuff about how am I going to be in the world. It really doesn't matter what my grades are. It doesn't matter whether I'm rich or poor. None of that matters. It's how am I going to interact with this culture that I barely understand. I think even today there's very few books about Niger you can read to get prepared.
And so you come back after 2 years. Did you come back to the U.S.? And did you know then that you wanted to do grad school, or was there some time in between the Peace Corps and...
Lots of time, in a sense. Or I should say, I came back, I went back to Boston, where I'm from. I got a job at a place called the Boston Center for Adult Education, where I would program classes, and it was very fun. And there were people there who had graduated from the Harvard School of Education. And so that seemed all of a sudden an option. I started looking at jobs, and I thought, everything that looks interesting to me, I thought I wanted to go back overseas, you needed a graduate degree for. So I interviewed people. I did informational interviews. And people would say, it doesn't really matter what you get a degree in. So I did a one-year master's degree at the Harvard School of Education because it was close by, and it seemed less work than doing other things. And that was like a side trip that I took. So for 5 years, I worked in human rights work. I worked for Amnesty International.
Wow. I didn't know any of this about you. It's fascinating.
I got around. I did. I really did.
Okay. So you take your side trip, and then what happens next?
Okay. So 5 years working at Amnesty International, doing some travel for them, but mostly in New England. And then I took a class at night just because a friend of mine was taking it. She's like, hey, there's this poetry class. This woman teaches it out of her living room. I've heard good things. I was like, okay, but I'm going to back up for a minute because I hadn't written any poetry after those teachers told me as an undergraduate that I should go do something else. I believed them.
Children's books.
So when I got this job at Amnesty International and I had a little bit of stability in my life, I took a watercolor class because I thought, okay, I need an artistic outlet. And I was a terrible painter. I still am. Just the worst in the whole class. But I loved it because I didn't have to feel any pressure that I was ever going to become a watercolorist, if that's even a concept. So that sort of letting myself paint and just I'd get home from class and I would paint all night long led me back to feeling like, okay, I can forge a new relationship with poetry. It doesn't have to be school. This woman teaches around her dining room table, which was really important to me. I wasn't going into a classroom. And through that kind of night class, it just developed more and more and more until my parents got ill and I got this real strong sense that like they were super healthy one day and then they died of cancer within a few months. So it was this kind of, you're fine, you have your whole life, and then you don't. And that made me think, what do I really want to do? I really want to be a writer, and I might as well give it a try because you get one life. And if I don't do it now, it will just go by.
And so once you had made that decision, what was sort of your list of steps that you decided to take to move towards that goal?
I had, again, with a friend, it makes me sound so passive, but I think so often in life things happen by these kind of fortuitous accidents. A friend of mine was going to Breadloaf for the summer.
Oh, right.
And
for those of our listeners who might not know, it's a writer's conference?
It's a writer's conference. At the time, and this was 20 years ago, it was also very layered. There were teachers, and then there were fellows, and then there were people on scholarship. But we were what were called, like, the loafers. We were the ones that were, like, putting the money out to make this all happen. So it was the lowest level, but we didn't know that. So I was like, okay, we actually had forced time off that year. Amnesty wasn't doing well financially. And so Linda Paston was teaching there. And I had once seen Linda Paston, the poet, read when I was in high school. And I thought, oh, it'd be kind of fun to work with her. So I sent the application in. I miraculously got accepted. And I had a half an hour one-on-one with Linda Paston. And she was a little like Madeline DeFries in that there's not a lot of warm fuzziness coming from her. But at the end of the time, you know, she kind of told me which poems she liked and which poems. She said, you're good poems and you're bad poems. And then at the very end of the whole 2 weeks, she came running up to me and she said, stay in touch. I want to follow your career. And what I did was go like this. Because I assumed she was talking to someone behind me.
You looked over your shoulder.
And that was very powerful because I hadn't decided to go to graduate school yet. I really, you know, I still had that thing that I'm not supposed to do this. Those teachers told me, you can't, you're no good. And so for Linda Paston to say I was going to have a career seemed like the most absurd thing. But that, coupled with my parents getting ill, made me apply to graduate schools, and I wanted some place that I could get a full ride because I was still paying my graduate student loans from the Harvard degree, and University of Oregon offered me a full scholarship and a teaching fellowship. So that was how I got to the West Coast.
Did you apply all over the country, like everyone that had like fully funded graduate?
Yeah, places that had fully funded or places that I knew would give money. So, you know, I remember one place saying, well, you know, if you have a full ride from Oregon, you should go there. So, I didn't want to go into debt again. And Oregon seemed to really want me. They called me up. I was one of their top picks. And I'd never been there, so I flew out. Everybody was nice. It was beautiful. It was springtime. And it changed my life.
And so you fly out, you pack everything up. Did you fly or drive out?
I flew. I wish I had driven, right? That would have been, I didn't own a car.
Right.
I was from Boston. Nobody has a car. So I put my stuff on a UPS truck and I came out.
And so immediately what was that like to be thrown from this world of the Peace Corps and teaching at Amnesty International, then to be thrown like headfirst into academia? Like both, not only learning, but then teaching others.
Yeah. Well, in Eugene, Oregon, which they had said when I looked it up was a city. And if you've ever been to Eugene, Oregon, I mean, maybe it has the third largest population in the state, but it was not what I expected. So I can remember calling to try to, this is going to sound so East Coast, but I called up to get the New York Times delivered and they told me, oh no, not on your side of town. If I had lived where the professors lived, which I most certainly did not, I could have gotten the New York Times. So it was an interesting mix because you're right. I'm teaching in a college, and that, you know, and that's kind of the lure that they bring is that as a graduate student, you're immediately teaching poetry to undergraduate students. So that was very exciting, and I didn't feel particularly well equipped to do it, but you learn by doing. On the other hand, I'd lived in Harvard Square in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where there were, you know, Mark Doty and Jane Hirschfeld in 1 week. That wasn't unusual. And I came out to Eugene where they proudly told me they would have one poet come every 3 months.
Wow.
So it was a culture shock in many different ways. And the group, they fully fund us, but there were six poets and six fiction writers in our program. So we were a tiny cohort from all over the country and very diverse. And in a way, it was like Peace Corps.
What were the... It's a bunch of people with different backgrounds just sort of thrown together in a new... Excuse me. In a new environment. What stood out for you, your time there, both when you're learning poetry, did you slowly kind of get that momentum of feeling confident in yourself? Like, I was their top pick. I'm here to... I mean, what was having that unadulterated writing time like?
Again, I'm not a particularly confident person, so no, it didn't feel like I had been anointed at all. In fact, our teachers were very, how can I say this delicately? They had other concerns other than their graduate students, so we were left alone a lot. And it really was like having all these siblings, and I don't have a lot of siblings, so I like that in terms of my fellow students.
Sure.
And it was like, okay, the world is not going to care if we write another poem. It's not going to be like people waiting, like, come on, Susan, get that extra stanza done. So we thought, okay, this is great practice. Nobody here cares what we're doing, and the world won't care. But it's true that in our culture, or in the culture I was brought up in, education really means something. And so we talked a lot as a cohort of students that we would have a shingle to hang outside. And in fact, someday, in fact, there is a shingle behind that coat that says the poet lives here. The idea is that if you get a degree in something, you are, the culture will take you more seriously, and therefore you will take yourself more seriously. So although I didn't really believe it would get me a job, I didn't really believe that I would have a book, I knew that taking that degree and taking 2 years out of my life would force me to see myself differently. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So after your time there, what happens next? I feel like this is like a choose your own adventure novel. What happens next? What happens after that grad school?
Oh, well, then it's good. I mean, then I'm unemployed and have to get a job. So I'm looking, and we're pre-cell phone, which is important because we have answering machines, and I'm on the campus of the University of Oregon checking for jobs and not getting very far when I get this phone call on my answering machine from Melissa in Washington, D.C. I do not know anyone named Melissa, nor do I have friends in D.C. So she was inviting me to come, and what she said was, "Hello, I'm calling from the Organization for Education and Development in Europe, and we're looking for electoral supervisors for the upcoming Bosnian elections, and you fit our profile perfectly." I had never been to Bosnia-Herzegovina. I did not speak any Balkan languages, and all I had ever done in an election was vote. So I assume she had the wrong number.
Right.
But she left a number for me to call back. And what it really meant was that they, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which goes by OSCE, had never done an election before. And they were looking for former Peace Corps volunteers who would not freak out about electricity going out, bullets coming by, water being scarce. They needed people to go and kind of do this crazy job. So that was what happened right after I graduated, which was, you know, kind of perfect timing because I could take 8 weeks out of my life and go and do that work, which was wonderful, wonderful work. And didn't lead to another job. Some people just managed to stay in Bosnia after that job. I don't think I had that kind of bravery because there was still really a war going on. It was just on pause at that point. Clinton was going up for re-elections, and he wanted to be able to claim peace in the former Yugoslavia. Anyway, I came back from there, and I had a Fulbright. I went to South Africa. So, don't get a job. Just keep traveling and find someone that'll give you enough money
for that. Fulbright, that's a big deal. Like, what? Like, were other what motivated you to apply for that?
I am a lover of travel. And I like to travel really far away for long periods of time, and I don't have a trust fund. It's kind of a problem.
Sure.
So Fulbright is perfect because it's a year-long program, and you're funded, and you kind of make it up. It is a choose-your-own-adventure. Exactly. You find an idea, and you write up a project, and you hope that someone thinks it makes sense. So I needed a country That was English speaking because my French is pretty terrible. And I had done all this human rights work, so I knew a fair bit about South Africa. I had lived in Africa before, and my project was to interview poets, South African poets. Nelson Mandela had been released from prison after 27 years, and he had become the first black president of South Africa. And so it was a country that was going through transition, and I wanted to go and kind of mark that transition.
When you were interviewing people, what were some of the common themes that were coming back at you, or how did that inform the way that you approached your poetry?
It's a good question, and I'm not sure there was kind of a direct cause and effect, although I think I learned a cautionary tale that some of the poets I interviewed, not all of them, had really been what were called kind of struggle poets, who had really written about apartheid and had had that as their main topic. And then all of a sudden, with the new South Africa, things looked very different. And so you had to sort of find a new relationship to your work. And a lot of poets, it's the idea that your poetry can't exist only as political rhetoric. I might want to write about the Black Lives Matter movement now. In fact, I do want to write about that, and I have tried, and I am writing about that. But if I don't have a real strong sense of lyric and craft and movement beyond having a political agenda that I want to get across, then the poetry's not going to work. And so I read some fantastic poetry, and I met some amazing poets, and I read a lot of terrible poetry of people who had actually gone to prison for their beliefs, but the poetry was another way to give a speech. So the whole gamut. And so I learned that being well-meaning isn't enough. I think I already knew it, but I learned it deeply.
During your time there. When all the interviews were done, when the year was over, did you publish something? What did you do with the findings? Like, what was the culmination of the project?
Now I feel like someone's going to come find me out and come and ask for that fellowship money back. Because I was there on Fulbright is tiered into three different layers, at least it was. And one was you've just gotten your BA and you can apply for a certain kind of Fulbright. The other one is that you're working on your PhD dissertation, and that's one kind of Fulbright. That's what I had, although I wasn't working on a PhD dissertation. And then the final type is a professor that does an exchange program and goes from one university to another. So I took interviews, and I did not write the interviews up. I had somebody transcribe them, so somewhere in behind that wall, I still have them. I wrote poems about my experiences in South Africa. I got very involved with one particular poet, Ingrid de Kock, who has now published a book in the U.S. as well, and did reviews of her work, and wrote about Elizabeth Bishop and her relevance to South Africa. But I didn't do a big project that showed this is what I've done this year. It was too bizarre a year. I think if you've done any long-term travel to stay somewhere, I actually was there 18 months, it's still hard to get your head around the place that's in absolute transition as an outsider, not kind of knowing exactly where I wanted to go with it. But my first and second books have poems about South Africa. So it came out, and it came out in my teaching, but not in a nice wrapped up gift with a bow.
Sure. No, that makes sense. The next chapter of your adventure, is it back in the United States again, coming back here?
Yes, my next do-your-own-adventure was, okay, you know, the money runs out when you do things like Fulbrights or working overseas. So I came back to Eugene, Oregon, where I had parked the car I owned. And I had sublet an apartment, and I was able to get that apartment back. And then it was a hard time. My friends who'd gone to graduate school, now they've had 18 months out of school. Everybody's settled.
Right.
People have jobs. And I'm starting way back at, like, hi, I'm back here. So I decided through, I don't know if attrition is really the right word, through having no other choices, I would become a freelance writer, which sounds so much better than unemployed. It sounds so much better.
Right.
And my expenses in Eugene were super, super low. Um, So it made it possible for me to kind of have something where I didn't have to bring in a lot of income. I taught a class at the University of Oregon, and I did book reviews, and I worked for the museum writing exhibit notes. And it was kind of fun. But I realized I don't have the right personality for doing freelance, because I remember, like, it was January 2nd, and I had no job set up. I'm like, okay, here's the year 1999, and all right, let's see if the phone's going to ring.
I totally understand. I see people who are freelance writers, and I think there's a certain tenacity you have to have, it's a very specific personality that I think does really well with that. So when you decided that wasn't exactly for you, what did you do?
Well, I kept applying for teaching positions, and I would, you know, this, I remember it was months and months, and I got that, like, I had made it to their, like, finalist round, but they didn't want to interview me. So I was like, all right, I made it to someone's, like, pre-interview round. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I really didn't. I guess I was thinking teaching might not be for me because I wasn't getting anywhere with my applications. I was sending my book out to try to get that published as well. And then in the spring, I had 3 offers of places to teach. But that was after, like, you know, it sounds great, but remember that there were like 8 months before that where
you,
I was
just
like,
did not know. Yeah.
Guess not. So, yeah, so I came here. Seattle won.
And we're lucky to have you.
Thank you. Oh, but I should say that when I was in graduate school, one summer, I came up for Hedgebrook. I had gone.
It was during that time.
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess someone had told me about this fairly new, I think it had only been around about 7 or 8 years, and it sounded like a cool thing. I'd never been to Washington State. So I applied, and I was accepted, and then I had to get here, which doesn't sound like a big deal, but I guess it was the summer between my 2 years of graduate school. So I'd been back in Boston, my dad had passed away, we cleaned out his house, and then I came back here. I had since bought a secondhand car, and somebody told me about a friend of a friend, so I stayed the night in Seattle, and then I drove up, and I absolutely fell in love with the city of Seattle. I fell in love with Hedgebrook, and I remember thinking, what did people do in a past life to get to live in the most beautiful place I'd ever seen? And I've been a lot of places. So the Hedgebrook experience, I think, changed me in terms of it's the summer that I always call the summer of hell, having to deal with my parents' things and breakup of the family. And then the summer of heaven when I arrived at Hedgebrook for 6 weeks in August and September.
That's like the best time just in terms of the would-be weather. And that was still the time when the chefs would go through the woods like Little Red Riding Hood, and they would deliver your lunches to your door.
Right, pre-golf cart. So they would just kind of walk up and leave the lunches. And there was a different woman who's not there anymore named Denise, but she came up with me to get my, you know, cottage all ready. I was in Owl that first year. There was a bowl of fruit there on the shelf, and there were flowers. And then she just gave me this hug and said, you know, welcome. And I just had never been treated that well in my whole life. I really don't think I ever had. So that idea that's now called radical hospitality but existed way before it was named was something that changed my life, that kind of generosity, because I was a writer, but I wasn't a published writer. I'm glad that I went at that point in my career, because my career hadn't existed yet. And this last summer when I went back to Hedgebrook, I could see I was with a lot of young women that were in their kind of late 20s, early 30s. And I just felt their kind of like giddiness at being at Hedgebrook and their excitement and their trepidation, because I could see that they're going to be fantastic writers. They have it. But they don't know that yet. And so they would see me as a role model, as a way to be a writer in the world, which I was like, really? So it was a wonderful full circle.
So getting a little emotional.
Oh, cool. That's good.
All right. So, fast forwarding a little bit. So, you come up to Seattle to teach where?
What's now called Highline College, right near the airport.
And so, what were your first assignments to teach, of classes to teach?
Well, it's interesting. It's sort of like graduate school where people want you to be really happy in your first few years so that you'll stay. So I got to make up some classes. I taught a class on women's travel literature really early on, which was very fun. I also taught the equivalent to freshman comp, which is less fun. But Highline is it's a wonderful, wonderful place to teach because we're allowed to really do things the way we want. So I could teach comp through a world literature class. In fact, I was hired to teach world literature, so I was teaching a class on world literature. And I think creative writing. So the first couple of years, I had lots of energy, and I would make up classes all the time. I would just start new classes, and it was fun.
So where in this timeline do you get your first book of poetry published?
It's a good question. So I'm sending it out as soon as I get back from South Africa. In fact, I even send some from South Africa because I think foreign stamps are going to help somebody look at me. And I'm trying to think. So I had sent things to White Pine Press. Originally, I had sent this South African poet's work because I thought she should be published in the U.S., Ingrid de Kock, and at that point she hadn't been. And then how can I condense this story? I was still in South Africa, and I knew a publisher. I knew my friend Ingrid's publisher, and he said to me a week before I was leaving the country, "Oh, Susan, can't I help you publish your book?" And I remember saying, well, that, and my response, being in South Africa, very proper, well, that would be very nice, Gus. He said, well, you're leaving South Africa, so it's really not going to help you if I publish you. But surely you must know a publisher in the U.S., and then I could collaborate with them, and we could publish in both places. Don't you? And I was like, no, Gus, I don't know any publishers. I mean, that was before publishers were kind of spreading out. Right. So, no, my friends at Knopf are non-existent. So he wrote, I said, if I have some publishers I would love to be published by, and maybe if you write them, they'll pay some attention. So he wrote to 6 publishers, and the only one that responded in a kind way was White Pine Press, and they asked to see more work. And so Dennis and I we emailed back and forth in, this would have been 1999, and December 1st, 1999, I had had my first and only full car collision. And then I got home after the police and after sort of being checked out to make sure I was okay. I had a minor concussion. And on my computer was a message from Dennis at White Pine Press. And it just said, "The news you have been waiting for, we will be publishing your book."
Wow.
And all that night, I woke up kind of all achy and thought, I am, my car's totaled. I'm a wreck. I'm so happy. And then we'd go back and forth.
I'm being published.
So, yeah. So by the time I got to Highline in September of 99, my book came out in April 2000.
And how many, in the years between, how many collections have been published?
Last year was my fourth. Four collections, all by White Pine.
Can you talk a little bit about how you see as a poet, the publishing landscape change? Like, it's happening so fast, and I would just like to see, hear your perspective about what it was like to be trying to get published, then and now.
Right. So at that point, I mean, in terms of how you go about getting published, I think it hasn't changed that much in that as a unknown poet trying to get your first book of poetry published, I applied to contests. I just sent to contests. And I was a finalist in a few different places, and that gave me confidence that maybe eventually someone might take it because at least I was placing. But the way my first book got taken was I'd approached him because of another poet. And then I wrote some articles for Poets and Writers, so he knew my name that way. And when I finally met him after our internet correspondence and kind of asked him, why did you take my book? Because he's a man of few words. There was never anything about my actual work. his answer to me was, "You're the first poet who's ever approached me on behalf of another poet." So I have kept that always. And when I kind of used to teach for the EDGE program that Artist Trust does, I would talk about community and generosity and how you never know. I go back to that day in South Africa when Gus Ferguson said, "Oh, Susan, can't I help you publish your book?" I was at a reading at like 11 o'clock on a Saturday morning, which I had barely got myself to support other poets. So to answer your question, it was about getting your first book contest, but it was also about making contacts and community. And at that point, I had no understanding that that's what I was doing, but indeed, that is what I was doing, and that is what helped me get that book published the first time. At that point, I didn't know anyone who had a book of poems published, really. Kelly's books weren't published yet. Peter Pereira's weren't published. Elizabeth Austin's, Kathleen Flint, all these friends of mine who now have books and are fantastic poets, because there were less opportunities. There were just less presses out there. And so what I've seen is, as other people who are fiction writers or nonfiction writers complain about what's happening in the publishing world, poets are having this incredible kind of renaissance of, let's start a press, so let's publish poetry. Sure. It's just become easier, cheaper, faster, and with the internet accessible in terms of getting your word out there. So I see many more people getting published, and I think that's great.
Do you think there's something has to... I was just wondering this when you brought that up. A poem... I don't know. A poem is just more compact. It's not, you don't have to have that relationship with an editor where it's like, well, I think you need to take this character out or in a different direction. Do you think the brevity of it helps?
The brevity of it helps in terms of, I think what you're saying is there's less of an editorial process poems. So maybe the fact that editors are getting cut, you don't need as much of an editorial process. Although I know Norton, Alice James, a lot of those presses really do, Copper Canyon, they do take their editing role seriously. But White Pine, way before I was part of the White Pine family, published fiction, and they no longer do. And I think that was because fiction is more pages, and more pages means more printing costs.
Right.
So I think that was a big part of it. And also, if you're publishing fiction as an independent small press, you're bumping up pretty hard against the big five. But if you're a poet publishing poetry, it's nobody's making money on poetry. Even,
right,
you know, HarperCollins, they're just not, unless it's the, you know, poetry of maybe Audrey and Rich or Jane Hirschfield and Naomi Shihab Nye. But you could probably count about 20 poets. Maybe if you were really stretching it, you could get 50. And then the rest of us, it's a job of love.
Absolutely. So I was lucky enough to take a class with you and Kelly at, it's not Women and Women First, that's the name it's called, in the Portlandia.
In other words, bookstore.
Right, in Portland. When you were teaching us, you were talking about how you have a goal to be published in every state. That's how you've made submitting a game. Can you talk about your process?
Sure. I was sort of saying that I was diligent about this for maybe a decade and a half. And it was because I love mail. I had pen pals when I was little. I collected stamps. And the idea that my poems were going to travel to states I'd never been was so exciting to me. I just thought, for the price of a stamp and then a self-addressed return envelope, I can go to Alaska, I can go to Hawaii, all these states I've never been. And at the time, I was living in Massachusetts. So when I got published in Alaska, where I had never been, where I still have yet to go, it was thrilling. And it seemed to me, and it was really just by a process of, like most things in my life, dumb luck, that I figured out, oh, well, I probably am not going to get published by the New Yorker, at least, you know, not anytime soon. So I can publish in these other places, and this is really fun. So I actually started out only sending to states I had never been to. And then I thought, okay, I can expand it a bit to include like places that I lived. I thought that would be kind of fun. And it just became a way for me to not worry so much about the big journals. So, okay, Poetry, New Yorker, those places are going to be really hard to get into. But that's not my goal. My goal is to get something in every state. And I care about the quality of the journal. And, you know, nowadays with the internet, I can look at the journal and I can see who they publish. But I liked the idea of being able to have an audience that was around the country and wasn't only other poetry readers. That was important too. So every year I've been able to tick a number off my list. There's some states that are much harder because I believe Rhode Island only has one journal, which I have been published in, called Roger. And there's one state, Delaware, where I still haven't seen if they actually have any journals where you don't have to be from Delaware in order to send.
Oh.
So I'm down to 3 or 4 states now, and I'm getting a little nervous.
You're like 46 states. That's incredible.
Over many years. I say that and I feel so old.
I want to know what's the story of you and Kelly meeting?
I invited her out on a date. But first I met her in a workshop at Richard Hugo House. It was Naomi Shihab Nye, and I was Naomi Shihab Nye's. I love saying this because it's the only time I've ever had the job of being an escort. But I was the escort service for Naomi Shihab Nye.
Okay.
Picked her up at the airport,
sure.
Took her to her hotel. I was her driver. So as a thank you for that, I was able to take her workshop. And in that workshop was Kelly. And Kelly had done a broadside. And I just remember Kelly went up to Naomi and seemed so, like, confident and able to talk to her. And so I kind of, like, recognized her at that point. But we didn't really get to know each other until 9/11, September 11th, where Kelly was one of the organizers to get as many poets as she could to do a reading in support of peace at the old Elliott Bay. And I think maybe 60 or 70 poets Wow. showed up to read just one poem. So I met her there. And I don't remember our conversation, but I know we must have talked. And Kelly's 10 years younger than I am. So she seemed at that point a very kind of young and upcoming poet. And I asked her if she would meet with me to talk about poetry and the internet. It sounds so funny. I can't believe I said that without bursting out laughing. But it was a question about whether one should publish on the internet. Is that lesser than publishing in a paper journal? And is it a good thing to have your poems out there for consumption or not? So we met downstairs at the old Elliott Bay. I always tell her I remember exactly what coat she had on because she looked kind of like Harriet the Spy. She had like on this like raincoat that had a tie. And I guess we liked each other because that was really the beginning of our friendship. How I was kind of, you know, brave enough to do that, I'm not really sure, but she knew my work, and I don't think her book was about to come out, so it was a good time to meet.
And how soon after that did you get the idea to teach together?
I love this story. Kelly's bored with it, but I think it's really fun. So I will tell you, because I love this story. Kelly and I were at a writing residency together, and it must have been about 6 years ago. And we were drinking wine. It was the evening, so we'd written all day, and then we would get together for dinner and share work and drink wine. And we were sort of, I'll be honest, we were complaining a bit about some of the conferences we had taught at. I had taught in a stairwell that was unheated. People Wow. who were in charge who just didn't understand the niceties of the small details of life. And so we said, if we ran a writing retreat, we would do things so differently. We would give presents to everyone and we would make everybody feel really loved. And so we started thinking, what would that look like? Because we had taught at many different conferences. I teach full time. We had a lot of experience, but we didn't really know what it would be like to organize our own conference. So first we came up with a name because we like names. We came up with Poets on the Coast pretty quickly, and Kelly Googled it to make sure nobody else had it, and we realized it was ours. And then we thought about, well, what coast? Where on the coast will we be? And she had stayed at the Sylvia Beach Hotel in Oregon and had loved it. And it's a hotel that every room is dedicated to a different writer, and it's right on the beach.
Wow.
So I had worked for Amnesty International. My job had been putting together conferences. So I called them, and I, you know, again, I'm very hesitant, but I remember calling for Amnesty. I said, well, where are these writers? And would it be possible to block some rooms? And what they told us was that they just seemed like a miracle. So I must have called them in December. Now I'm really bad with the years. December of 2009, maybe, around there. Let's just say that. That's okay. A nice round number. And what they told me was that they would book the hotel for us. They would completely hold it. This is December. And then in June or so, if we weren't going to use it all, just let them know how many rooms we needed. And really, although our conference was in September, they would let us kind of play with room numbers up until August.
Wow.
With no cost. And so all of a sudden it became like, okay, if we don't have to put down a big deposit, which is what we expected and which we really couldn't do, then let's see what happens. And most of our advertising is all on our blogs and Facebook and different places on the internet and posters at open books. So we just, it was really like that baseball movie, like if we build it, will anybody come?
A Field of Dreams, yeah.
Yes, it was our Field of Dreams. And I just remember so vividly, we're driving down the highway and people had signed up. People came from different states. We were just utterly surprised and delighted. And we're driving the, it was like a 7-hour drive down to Florence from here, saying, now, where are we having the opening party? Did we figure out where the opening party was? And then, you know, we ended up in I-5 got closed for Prairie Fire. We were late to our own reception. And that was the beginning. But we kind of realized that women really wanted what we had to offer. And that was kind of the big surprise. We had invented this thing in our head, like a Field of Dreams. But on the ride home, we just kept talking about how we hadn't expected to really kind of see women transform before our eyes, who had really taken this risk, who didn't see themselves as writers necessarily, who did all sorts of different things in their daily lives. And that by us coming together and creating this community, we had done what was needed for a large group of women.
Can you talk about the decision? Did you know from the beginning you just wanted it to be women in community?
We did. I think we just felt like there was a need for kind of women to come together. It's a different type of energy when we get a large group of women together. And I think we said, we'll try it this first year and then we'll see if it makes sense. And it was immediately apparent that it made sense. And whether that was partially kind of Hedgebrook kind of pressing on me is that was the community that had really helped me see myself as a writer. Maybe. So it just kind of naturally happened, and then we're like, yeah, that feels right.
So how many people women did you have register the first year?
I think it was 18, which is a really nice number. And women from Oregon, somebody from California, someone from Baltimore, mostly from Northwest, but a lot of women who knew us through our blogs, which was kind of exciting that people had found us that way. And different ages, although oftentimes people who have the time and the money to come tend to be a little bit older. But our range from the years we've done this is probably 21, 22 to 84.
That's amazing. And has it grown just a little bit more each year? And then this year it's in LeConnor. When did you move it up?
Last year we decided that it was time to get someplace a little bit bigger because we have gotten bigger and bigger, and that for most of the people are coming from Seattle area. And so the drive down, we went through, like I said, the Prairie Fire the first year, and then there was a year where none of our people got hit by lightning, but the storms were so bad that we saw people hit by lightning along the way.
Wow.
So it started seeming like a very dangerous route. You know, I mean, you know, given that I've been in Bosnia and South Africa, you wouldn't think that I-5 to Florence was a scary route, but we just decided maybe it would work a little better. And LeConnor, the Country Inn and the Channel Lodge are used to having conferences, so they're fantastic to work with. They're set up to give us rooms and Xerox copies, and it's just it's an easier place to have right. a large group of women.
And so people can still, women can still sign up for this. Right?
Women can still sign up. I think we have about 2 places left.
Wow. And they can get more information at...
Poets on the Coast. I should know this. .weebly.com, I believe.
And I'll have that in the episode description. And then what's your can you talk about the title of your blog? I very much enjoy your blog and the frequency and type of posts that
Thank
you do.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's called The Alchemist Kitchen. Because I started it about 6 months before my third book, The Alchemist Kitchen, came out, and I didn't know enough about social media to realize, oh, what am I going to do once the book is out and there's another book? But I love the name, and so it's going to stay The Alchemist Kitchen. And the focus is on poetry, travel, and the creative life. So I felt like that would give me enough kind of movements through. And... the frequency, like many bloggers, I started out, I was a dedicated everyday blogger, and then I went to 5 days a week. And now it's just like, I'll blog if I have something to say, yeah. and I want it to be something often that's useful. I love doing lists, so I have a list of things you should think about before you apply to a residency, things to think about before you apply to a hedge book residency, what I learned after doing a book launch, things to think about. So I love having kind of a lot of very easily, quick, accessible tips for people. And then I also do reviews of books of poems. If I'm really kind of moved by a book of poems, I like to be able to do that. If I find a poem somewhere of someone I don't know, it's really fun to just post that and say, look what I found today. So all sorts of different things. I have posts about the House of Sky, which is the name of my writing studio, about... you know, how much it cost and the decision to do it and really the idea that it is worthwhile to have a designated space. So sometimes it's pictures of my cat, but mostly it's about writing.
And that's thealchemistskitchen.blogspot.com. Okay, and we'll have that in the episode description as well. As we kind of wrap down, wind down our interview here, what would you say your biggest piece of advice for poets is, or aspiring poets, people of all levels who enjoy writing poetry?
Think of it as a lifelong relationship. It's a type of lover, and your lover needs, you know, time, just the two of you at the desk working. And then I think most relationships also need some time kind of out there in the world, in the community. And so having kind of a balance that it's really important to put in the hours of, for me, revision after revision of work. And I love that solitude. But if that was all what I did was spend time in this gorgeous space and write, I don't think I would be as good a writer as I am, if that's not sounding too bizarre, because I have a community of writers who I can say, hey, what are you reading that's exciting? And let's put on a project. I did poetry at a hotel where Elizabeth Austin and Kelly and I and Harold Taw all dressed in our pajamas and read poems out of a bedroom suite. So I think it's about integrating poetry into all aspects of your life, that the idea of a poet alone in a garret just kind of sweating and hoping that they get one amazing poem that they will be remembered forevermore is not really sustainable as a way to live. And so there's not many things in my life that I've been doing as long as I've been writing poetry. I've just been too nomadic, and there's too many things that pull me in different directions. But I think the reason that my poetic life has continued is because I've found all these different roots in by a fantastic friendship with Kelly Russell Agadon and Elizabeth Austin and Kathleen Flanagan, with starting this retreat and being able to mentor other women and help other women. And I edit a magazine in Turkey for their poetry. So just finding that as a new writer, you really have to find your tribe, and you have to push yourself out of your comfort zone and do things that allow you to grow in ways that you can't see, as opposed to just worrying about, oh, I need to know a publisher in New York, or I really have to get this poem published at X journal before anyone takes me seriously. I think that would close me down, because those things they're out of our control. What if they don't happen? But deciding I have something to give and I'm going to teach by the ocean in Oregon, anyone can do. So I think it's about finding your own personal relationship to the work and taking the work into the world.
I think that's a lovely place to end this interview. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Sure. Thank you so much for listening to my stories.